Special Sauce is brought to you by Soyve. Unlock the awesome with marinades like Very Very Teriyaki and Hoisin Garlic.
Welcome to Special Sauce, Sirius Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I am such a careful gambler, you won't believe it. If I lose 10 bucks, I am so upset. And meanwhile, I'm willing to bet $10 million on investing in a new restaurant.
This week, we have with us the man without whom you can't get a good burger in Bahrain, Danny Meyer. He's the CEO and founder of the Union Square Hospitality Group, and he operates everything from white tablecloth restaurants to burger stands at ballparks to a jazz club in New York City. Meyer is also chairman of the board of the hamburger stand Shake Shack, the now publicly traded company with more than 60 locations everywhere from the U.S. to the U.K. to Bahrain. Danny is also the author of the best-selling business book cum memoir Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. Finally, he has been married to the lovely and talented Audrey Meyer for many, many years. How many years is it, Danny?
28 years very shortly.
28 years very shortly. No mean feat for someone who has been in the restaurant hospitality business all that time. Audrey and Danny have four wonderful children, all of whom I have met. A warm welcome to Audrey Meyer's husband and the father of four, Danny Meyer.
You've just assured another 2 years of marriage. That was great, Ed. Thank you. Audrey's the best.
First, I want to hear about life at the Meyer family table because you write a lot about it in the book. It seemed like food was super important from the moment you came out of the womb.
It's true. You know, my parents spent the first 2 years of their marriage living in a town called Nancy in France. My father, after graduating from Princeton, was selected because he had a real ear for language, and he was given a scholarship to go to the language school in Monterey, California, and then the U.S. Army asked him to be a counterintelligence officer, and it was perfect because it was a time in the early 1950s when there were no real conflicts between France and Germany or whatever. They spent the first 2 years of their marriage doing was eating food and meeting people who made food in their homes in France, who ran small country inns. They would, you know, drive a car through the French countryside. And to speed things up, after 2 years of being a counterintelligence agent in the army, come gastronome, my father and mom returned home to St. Louis, Missouri, and he started a travel business. And friends started asking him to design driving tours through the French countryside that would include eating and staying in these little inns. And lo and behold, these inns formed their own organization called Relais de Compagnie. And we would have the French children of these innkeepers staying in our home in St. Louis. And it then they then matched with Chateaus of Europe, and that became Relais and Chateau.
Wow.
And so my father became the first American agent for Relais and Chateau.
So he was doing foodie stuff well before anyone called anything foodie. We're talking about the 60s, right?
Yeah, and in the 1960s, our dog's name was Ratatouille, which was my dad's favorite dish to cook. So yeah, there were, you know, there were things that were happening in our family kitchen in St. Louis that were probably not happening in a lot of family kitchens elsewhere. And what was great for me was that none of this seemed foreign or unusual. There was French spoken at the table anytime my parents did not want us to understand.
Right.
What
my
they were
family
talking
was
about.
Yiddish. That's how much more cultured you are than I am.
Well, at least the food was pretty good.
That's true.
I don't
know
about the Yiddish wines, but the Beaujolais, it was pretty good on the table.
Yes. But you talk about even as a kid, like going to school, you were always looking at what other people were eating and were always asking for bites of sandwiches that you didn't recognize.
I mean, this goes back to the earliest memories I have of looking at people's lunch boxes to understand something about who they were as people. It wasn't just that I wanted to try someone's bologna sandwich whose family used Miracle Whip compared to someone whose bologna sandwich used Hellman's. It was something, it was just crazy, but it was, I guess, the beginning of my finding that my greatest avenue for learning about people is based on how they eat.
Yeah.
And to this day, when I go to a grocery store, I'm looking at the person in front of me to see what are they unloading from their shopping cart. And I'm not making judgments in the sense of looking down my nose at somebody, but I'm learning about them. When I go to a new city in a new country, I go to the markets. I find out how do they eat. I'm not really interested in finding food that is international when I'm going to another city. I'm interested in seeing what do the locals eat.
Yes.
And that's how I learn.
Yeah. I know. I drive my wife crazy because she wants to go to the churches and I want to go to the markets.
Well, I think there's an important feature to a good marriage, which is you should go to a couple churches every now and then.
Well, we once went on a barbecue tour of South Carolina where the deal was I would go to as many historic plantations and gardens as we went to barbecue joints.
Okay,
so there was a one-to-one. So that's why we've been married 34 years, I think.
And by the way, I would say that you can learn a lot based on how people go to church, too.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
There's something about the churches it's in true. The South that teach you about the South.
Yeah. You write very movingly and honestly about your childhood and family circumstances. You know, how you sort of navigated those not very easy waters.
Those not very easy waters, which I think every kid has in their own way, are a huge part of why I do what I do and why I am who I am. And also, I think we're all wired differently. But let me just kind of set the stage here. I'm the middle child of three in a family where my dad's family were staunch Republicans. My mom's family were staunch Democrats, a Chicago family and a St. Louis family. And the dinner table was not just about food. It was about arguing.
Yes. Oh, my dinner table was all about the arguing, you know, and the pork chops, but the arguing more.
You just told us a lot by telling me that it was about pork chops. But I don't really love arguing. What I found my role to be in our family was I just wanted everyone to get along because I found that I often sided with my father in terms of life issues, but I usually sided with my mother in terms of political issues.
That's funny. So there was a constant tug, and you were trying to find the middle ground.
And I was trying to make everyone get along. Mm-hmm. And that's what I cared about more than anything. I ended up every single night watching Walter Cronkite on TV with my mom. That's how we got close. Every night would cook with my dad, or we would play catch, football or baseball. That's how we got close. But it was this tug of war all the time. And meanwhile, my parents, I have to just share something. You kicked off this segment talking about my wife, Audrey. Audrey is a Catholic, and I'm a Jew. And early on in our, right, which is very standard these days, but early on, you know, when we first got married, there were people who said, how are you guys going to make that work? How will you bring up your kids? And I said, you know, hopefully with common values. And I think it's actually easier conducting a mixed religious marriage with shared political points of view or life points of view than it is. My parents had the exact same religion, but they just never saw it. They just canceled each other's vote on everything that they believed in.
And clashed on many, many things.
They did. Right? They did. I think that story actually says a lot because to this day, I care deeply about food, which is what my dad and I did together all the time. And I care deeply about issues. I was a poli-sci major. I thought I might want to be a lawyer. I thought I might want to get into politics. I did work At the age of 10, I was working as a volunteer for political campaigns. I only had one. I worked as a Senate elevator boy for the Missouri, actually for the U.S. Senate, but I was a Senate intern for our Missouri Senator Symington between high school and college, worked in the Connecticut legislature. And I had one professional political job as the Cook County field coordinator for John Anderson in 1980.
Wow.
But that says a lot, too, because sure. he was the independent.
Yes, he was.
He was not.
He was seeking
he was the guy in the
ground.
Middle. That's
he,
right.
And he was seeking common ground.
That's who I am. I'm straight down the center.
It's interesting because finding the middle ground is really the basis for your feelings about hospitality.
The basis for my feeling about hospitality is that however you felt before you came to work, I want you to leave work feeling a little bit better. It's like when you go out for a run, it may not, it's hard work during your run or during your workout, but I want you to feel better when you're done. And coming to work is hard work, but I want you to feel better. If you're a guest, I want you to, however you felt when you came into the restaurant, I want you to leave feeling a little bit better. That's how not only am I wired, but I also got an amazing education in making people feel better because of what we just spoke about with
yes,
my family position.
You were making people feel better at the dinner table.
And with respect to food, it just so happens that, you know, as M.F.K. Fisher wrote so beautifully, food and love are so inextricably
yeah.
linked that yeah. the provision of it or the denial of it has a huge amount to do, in my experience, with how you feel.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I don't see a couch in here. I can't quite lay down on the couch at this point. But, you know, there was I was a chubby kid as I went into adolescence. And I have my grandfather, my mother's father, was paying me a dollar for every pound I lost.
Wow.
And he gave me a calorie book. Which was, it's a crazy thing because it just was physiologically how I went through
yes.
puberty was chubby in.
I shopped at the Husky department,
I was,
too. Don't feel bad, man.
Well, I didn't feel great about it, but what happened was that I was then told not to eat stuff
yeah.
that I wanted to eat. And that just made me want to not only feed myself, but to feed other people.
Right. Make them
I don't
happy.
Want anyone
to be denied.
To be denied
yeah.
great food.
Yeah.
And so it's all there. And all I can say is I'm so glad I didn't end up being a lawyer because I don't think lawyers exist for the primary purpose of making people feel better.
No, they don't. You mentioned M.F.K. Fisher. And in the book, you know, the paragraph that you quote is one that is relevant to the discussion. It seems to me that our three basic needs for food and security and love are so mixed and mingled and entwined that we cannot straightly think of one without the others. So it happens that when I write of hunger, I am really writing about love and the hunger for it and the warmth and the love of it and the hunger for it. And then the warmth and richness and fine reality of hunger satisfied and it is all one. But what was really interesting to me because we all have read M.F.K. Fisher, is you related it to your family's housekeeper who really taught you a lot more about hospitality and love and getting along than many other people, Mary Frances Smith.
Well, you're almost bringing tears to my eyes. I mean, the quote that you just read from M.F.K. Fisher, I cannot think of a more beautiful or economical way to define why I do what I do and why it matters to me. And Mary Smith, who was our Mississippi-born housekeeper when I grew up in St. Louis, to whom I dedicated this book, Setting the Table, was the epitome of love. And not just because she would bake me, you know, these amazing
Layer cakes
for my birthday and cook the most remarkable fried chicken and macaroni and cheese and collard greens and sneak me tastes of it when no one was looking so I could get seconds so that when I sat down to the table for dinner, I had already had a dinner that no one knew I had already had. But it wasn't just what she did with respect to feeding. It was just the most non-judgmental ear. It was someone who communicated through her two ears.
And always had time to listen to what you had to say.
Yeah. I mean, I would go down to our basement where she would spend hours ironing. And the ironing for her was mindless at that point. And so those turned into listening sessions. And those
wow.
turned into...
She was your first therapist.
Oh, yeah. more than that. She probably saved me in a lot of different ways.
Really? Yeah. And you talk about when you opened Union Square Cafe that she paid her own way. She insisted on paying her own way to come to the opening, which
she
I thought was really says something about her.
Yep. She also did that at my wedding, which is amazing.
Yeah. That's great. So all these things are obviously coming together when you decide to go into the restaurant business, right? And you work at a restaurant in New York. First, you were a very successful salesperson at a company called Checkpoint, which I think I could figure out what they did. I think you sold the things that kept shoplifters from taking things out of stores.
That's right. And the big deal with our company, I had accepted a $16,500 a year job as special projects manager, meaning I did whatever the
right.
New York salesman wanted. And he left the company to go to our competitor probably within about 6 months of my
right.
arrival. And they handed me the entire New York
right.
territory. This was a newly public company.
It wow.
was traded over the counter, which is now known as NASDAQ.
Right.
And the stock was selling for about $2 a share. And they gave me the whole New York territory, and I became the top salesman in
wow.
the company. And I kept putting my commissions back into the stock, which went up to about 13
wow.
during the time I was
so
there.
So you were a savvy business person even back then.
Well, what I learned was that I loved working for commission.
Yeah.
And I also used my time as a New York salesperson. They gave me every salesman in the company got a company car that was leased, and everybody wanted these big fancy cars. I got a powder blue Volkswagen Rabbit, and I just drove it all over the place. And as you can imagine, a lot of our business was in some of the tough and tumble neighborhoods where shoplifting was at its highest. But I got to know all these Syrian Jewish families who were in the health and beauty business, in the retail business. Most of them lived in Deal, New Jersey, but their stores were in parts of Brooklyn, parts of Queens, some parts of Long Island. And I would always determine my sales pattern based on where I thought I could get a good lunch by myself. And that was, of course, before the internet, so you really had to do your
I'm
research.
Aware. That's how I wrote New York Eats in 1990.
Which was my Bible, but you hadn't written it by that point.
So you decide you're going to open a restaurant. You don't have a lot of money. I remember the restaurant that occupied the Union Square Cafe space, the original Union Square Cafe space, which was Brownies,
mm-hmm.
a really, really bad health food restaurant.
It was the first vegetarian yeah. restaurant in New York City.
I know.
49 years old when we took over.
And so what – I mean, you describe your dad as being an entrepreneurial gambler. You regard yourself as risk-averse, and yet – there's some point when you're deciding to open that restaurant where those two things come together.
Yeah, they absolutely did. Yeah, I wouldn't say that I'm risk averse. I have some conflicts. I mean, I love going to the horse races. And my dad took me to the horse races when I was 14, 15. By the time I was 16 and got a driver's license in St. Louis, which equated to independence, my pals and I would drive our car across the river to Illinois, and we would go to the horse races. And I actually got nailed one night by the head security guy there. He grabbed me by the shoulder for underage gambling, and he said, if I ever see you here again, I'm taking you to the Allerton County Jail.
Wow!
And I stayed away because I was scared to death, And 6 weeks later, I got the courage to go back. His hand was the size of a football, grabs me by the neck 6 weeks later, says, I thought I told you never to come back here. He takes me to jail at that
wow.
point.
Wow. This is news. Danny
yeah, this,
Meyer
I didn't write about this.
Jail.
Did not write about this in the book. But so I'm not averse to gambling, but I'm also a very, very careful gambler. And this is bizarre, but, you know, we have Shake Shack and we have a bar up at Saratoga Racetrack, and I love it. I am such a careful gambler, you won't believe it. If I lose $10, I am so upset. And meanwhile, I'm willing to bet $10 million on
sure.
investing in a new restaurant.
Sure.
That's an exaggeration, folks.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is Union Square Cafe and your whole philosophy of hospitality, which has guided you and guided so many people, I think, now. You've had great influence on the industry as a whole. I used to say, admiringly, by the way, that people think that Danny Meyer should get a MacArthur Genius Award because his big revelation was, if you're nice to people, they'll come back.
It's ridiculous, but think about where things were in the mid-1980s, which is when Union Square Cafe opened. We had that playing field all to ourselves because, you know, we had just come off the Studio 54
right.
Velvet Rope
Everything
era.
Everything was all about exclusion.
Yeah. The more I tell you you're not welcome and the higher the prices are, the more you want my product. That was the prevailing wisdom in the early 1980s, which is insane. And, you know, growing up in St. Louis, honestly, the food was not all that remarkable. There's three or four things, and
sure.
I tried to put them all to work in various
right.
Blue Smoke and Shake Shack.
Sure.
But the thing that St. Louis had that New York couldn't touch was people were nice to you. They remembered who you were. They cared. They remembered your favorite table. They didn't look down their nose like, now that you're in my restaurant, you better be nice to me or I'm not going to serve you your food. I couldn't get over that in New York City. So I don't think it takes a genius to say, well, but New York has some really good food. What's wrong with pairing good food with nice hospitality? Doesn't
Yes. It's so weird. It's so simple. And yet, as you say, at that moment, it was not obvious.
It's true. And I think initially I used to think, well, this is just as simple as the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. I think what I've learned over all these years is that the golden rule for hospitality is actually slightly different, but in a powerful way. I think the golden rule of hospitality is do unto others as you believe they would want done unto them, because it's not about me. For example, if I'm running a restaurant and I go, oh my gosh, Ed Levine is here. Let's send him out 5 mid-courses so he can see everything the chef does. That may backfire. I may be doing that with a hope that I'm doing something nice for you. But if that's not what you want, then mm-hmm. I'm actually doing it to you, not for you. That's and therefore,
not, and there's a, and that's
huge,
a distinction,
huge distinction
with a difference.
Big one.
No, that's really, really interesting. And you talk about hospitality for you is it starts with being nice to your staff, right? And because you think you have to set the whole thing in motion with them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm as convinced as I could possibly be that over the great arc of time, our guests will never have a better time dining in our restaurants than our staff members are having working with each other to create that experience. So, and I've also learned the distinction. It's not just how nice is Danny Meyer to his staff. There's not enough nice in me to go around. It's truly my responsibility to hire people who are nice to each other. Because when you come to work in any one of our restaurants, it almost has to feel like you're going to play with a team.
Mm-hmm.
And that the team has a mission, which is to win the game of hospitality. And the way you win the game of hospitality is you're solving problems to make people's lives feel better.
Yeah.
And you either, at the end of the day, you can look at the scorecard and you can say, of all the people who worked here, how many people actually feel better because they came to work today than if they had done something else? And how many of the people who came to dine here actually feel better than if they had never come here before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
what's great about that is it also eliminates competition. It's our court that we're playing on. You're not going to come back or not come back to one of our places based on who opened next door. You're going to come back or not come back based on what happened to you when you were in our Petri dish.
If you make a mistake, if a dish isn't perfect, because you're basically providing an hour and a half or a two-hour vacation from people's lives, right? Really, when you get down to it, they're going to be much more forgiving about a dish that they don't like or something came to their table that they didn't order if they feel that they're well taken care of and that this is a place that everybody is enjoying what they're doing, from the servers to the patrons.
Yep. They have to know that it mattered to us when we made a mistake, that we're on their side. And I think everybody understands that the most delicious plate of food in the world is not going to be able to overcome an inhospitable bad attitude on the part of your server. But we also know that a caring, thoughtful sense of hospitality can almost always overcome a mistake that a cook may have made.
Right, right.
Almost always.
And yes. So you sort of redefined perfection when it came to a restaurant experience.
Well, I want to push back on that because I feel really strongly that perfection is not only impossible, but it's not even worth pursuing. That's why I've really had a conversion over the years of being a professional restaurateur. I think, like so many people who grew up interested in the food business, we were looking to France.
And
you can't go to France, but you're looking at Michelin and you're looking at the aspiration of becoming a 3-star restaurant whose aspirations seem to equate with perfection, right? The Michelin inspector is any mistake is going to dock you something along the way. And I found a lot of early inspiration connected to the aspiration of earning a 3-star review from Michelin. It was fun when I used to own 11 Madison Park to have a team of people who aspired to that. And while I was the owner, we earned 3 stars from Michelin and 4 stars from the New York Times and a grand award from the Wine Spectator. And I during that same period of time, I think that what I started to love more than anything in France, and I take Michelin with a lot of grains of salt outside of France, but I think by and large, they get France pretty well.
Yeah.
But I loved the 2-star countryside Michelin restaurants way more than the 3-star perfect ones.
And that's not – those restaurants are not about the pursuit of perfection.
What they were about was they were putting really good stuff on the plate. You're not going to get 2 stars unless what's on the plate and in the glass is really good. But for me, the 2-star had a lot more to do with humble, generous hospitality.
Yes. There's a generosity of spirit.
There might be some rusticity that wouldn't earn 3 stars, but that's what motivates me. And so for the people who work in our restaurants, I really try to convey that the journey of excellence is far more interesting to me than the pursuit of perfection. And the journey of excellence means you've got to start every day honoring the work you did yesterday. Because human as you are, mistakes though you made, you gave it your best shot. You might have even woken up on the wrong side of the bed yesterday, but you're a human being. Honor that. And come to work today trying to figure out how you could do it. Name it, honor it, yesterday. But now figure out how could you do it a little bit better today. And if you do both of those things every day, it's actually fun to come to work with a group of people who are not just type A, I'm only happy if we achieve perfectionists, and nor are you coming to work just to hold hands and sing Kumbaya, don't feel great. But this balance of honoring your humanity, how can the recipient of our hospitality feel a genuine sense of love if the product we're trying to work towards is perfection.
Yeah.
Robots don't generally offer much love.
Yes.
So you got to put the humanity into hospitality.
Yes. And I guess that gets back to someone like Mary Frances Smith, right? She is the essence. She was the glue that held you and your family together, you know.
And she was, you know, safe parking for everybody.
Yes.
Whether you were a Democrat, Republican, Jew, she was a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. So
and she also kindled my love for Southern cooking.
Really?
I
ooh, my oh, I had a housekeeper too that made Lila that made the most amazing fried chicken ever. So we could do a fried chicken taste off.
I wish Mary were alive.
I think they're both. They've both.
But I would stand over. You know, I would go down on a Saturday afternoon to her house in the inner city of St. Louis. Generally, take my brother with me, and we would just spend the whole afternoon in her kitchen as she gently turned the fried chicken. I don't know how Lila cooked it, but she was using Crisco, and she would turn the pieces gently. Sometimes the top was on, so it would steam cook a little bit. But, you know, I could probably do it from scratch myself right now, and it would be sort of a fun thing to try to relive that. And we would come back just smelling of Crisco oil.
Yeah, yeah.
My mom knew what we had been up to.
There's so many more things I want to talk to you about that we're going to save for next week. But there is one final question about training, which I think plays a really important role in your restaurants, in your business. Because most restaurant training consists of trailing for a day or a week. And you have a very different way to do it.
Interestingly, you know, you're being very generous, but I think our training is good. I think our hiring is way better. And I think probably the best training we do is training people how to hire well.
That's been true with Serious Eats, by the way.
If you believe that the way someone makes you feel is even more important than how beautifully they served you, I'm not saying you don't get a free pass on the technical stuff whatsoever, but I think we can both agree that the way they made you feel is even more important than that. We've learned that we don't know how to train anyone to be motivated to make you feel good. That they came pre-stuffed with that. We're pretty good at training the technical skills, but what we're really good at is training how to spot the emotional skills that generally make up someone who has what we call a high HQ. High hospitality quotient.
Which is really empathy.
Empathy is one of the six emotional skills for sure. And you may say that's the most important of the, and we have to define what does that mean? And how do you interview someone and determine, you don't say, are you empathetic? Because,
right.
Oh, yes, very much so.
So what are the other five?
The first one is, they're all very obvious when you hear it, but like anything else, when you're intentional about it and you name it before you interview someone, you think about it during the interview, and then you think about it after the interview, it's really, really powerful stuff. So they're all obvious. The first one is optimistic kindness. So I'm looking for someone who makes me feel good. You know, they're kind. But I'm also looking for optimism. I believe that hope is the root of the word hospitality. If you're going to offer someone hospitality, part of the reason you're doing it, it's like giving a hug. You hope to get a hug back.
Right.
Skeptics and cynics don't tend to thrive in the world of hospitality. They may be great in the CIA, but that's not what we're doing. The second one is curious intelligence. We're looking at a lot of characteristics, but we're looking for people who view every single day as an opportunity to learn something new.
Okay.
And, you know, they walk to work on a different path every day just because you never know. There might be a new store that just opened.
Sure.
When you're done looking at that store, tomorrow maybe you look up at the cornices of the, you know, you learn mm-hmm. something new. The third one is work ethic. We can train anyone how to clear the table the right way, but we can't train someone to care about doing it properly. And the fourth one is empathy, which is a sense that how you make people feel really matters. and how people feel really matters. And the way we actually define that is as if each one of us is a boat going through life and leaving a wake in our path. And the question is, how aware are you of the wake you're leaving? Mm-hmm. And do you care how that wake is impacting the other boats? We're all, you know, there's a lot of things we're not responsible for. I'm not responsible for the good conditions into which I was born, the challenging conditions, but I am responsible for what I do with that, and that's the wake I leave. And then the fifth one is self-awareness. We define self-awareness as understanding what your own personal weather report is on any given day. And just as we know, every day you wake up, it's a little different outside. And most of us check the weather report the night before that morning, and we make adjustments. What should I wear? What should I not wear? I'm not wearing a heavy overcoat today. Checking your own weather report and saying, today I woke up grumpy. What am I going to do about it? Today I woke up excited. What am I going to do about it? Today I woke up exhausted. Today I woke up happy. And it's incredibly important in a team sport of hospitality to know your own weather report, because it will affect everyone else on the team. And if you're having a 72 low humidity sunny day, we want you shining on everybody. If you're having a 92 degree hot and humid stormy day, it's your responsibility to go do something about that. Go to the gym, go to the shrink, spend time with your family, stay away from your family. Whatever works, you got it. It's your job to do that, because we don't want to work with skunks. You know, a skunk sprays what it's angry at or afraid of, and
I don't want a skunk to be my server.
And everyone else within 2 miles has to smell the skunk, and they don't really know why it smells.
I've had skunk servers, too. I just want
you
to
know. I'm sure you have, and you spend your time unfairly trying to charm good service out of your server. I've seen you do that. Not in my restaurant, of course. And then the sixth, and for me it's the gating issue of all of them, is integrity, which is having the judgment to do the right thing, even when it may not be in your own self-interest. And so now you take all six of those emotional skills and you say, oh, and by the way, you know, I've never met a better fish sauté cook in my life. But the six emotional skills are really the motivators behind why is this fish cooking. I've seen really angry, perfect cooks who are cooking from a position of anger, not from a position of love, who really don't care how the product of their perfect fish made you feel, but they're doing it to show the next guy on the line how much of a better cook they are.
Sure.
I don't really want to hire that cook.
Yeah.
And one more thing, you and I talk about music all the time. When we hire musicians at the Jazz Standard, we're not just looking for technical proficiency. We're not just looking for the guy that can bend the reeds in the saxophone 18 ways till heaven to prove what a technically proficient saxophone player is. We're looking at the ground, and we're looking at people's feet. And if the audience is tapping their feet, and if the rest of the band members are having fun, that's what we're looking for.
Wow. So we're going to get to the Jazz Standard and our mutual love of jazz. But first, I want to thank you for coming on this week on Special Sauce, because it's always a pleasure. And what better way to spend time? Danny Meyer, thank you again. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.